for 10 seconds, I had a thought. Oh my gosh, is this real? Are they real? Before I kill myself and before I tell Susan about the mission and kill her, I better find out if this is real.
I've got a tale of sadness, poignancy, profundity, and absurdity today with Jan Broberg, who you may know from the Abducted in Plain Sight Netflix documentary. As a child, Jan was taken several times by her neighbour Robert Birchtold, a paedophile who tricked her parents and everyone else in the community into believing he was a good man. The title of Abducted in Plain Sight is in reference to the fact that Birchtold drugged Jan and convinced her she was an alien with a mission to procreate with Robert, with him. She spent much of her adolescence convinced that the voices he played on a tape were real UFOs. It's a really insidious and disgusting thing to do, and he molested her intermittently for some years. At one point, he even took her for months, changed her name, and enrolled her in a school. Upon the release of the Netflix documentary, a lot of people commented incredulously on the apparent naivety of her parents. Incredibly, Birchtold also manipulated both of her parents into affairs with him, although in the case of Jan's father, it was a one-time fondling, but it was part of a way of keeping them quiet and sort of feeling like they were complicit and everything, and there was a lot that they didn't know or realise. It's easy to fall into that culture of blame as it makes us feel superior. I did it myself to some degree. I'm obviously guilty of that as much as anyone, of blaming and judging and stuff. But, you know, the motto of this podcast, as I always say, and it often refers to more political things, is curiosity, not judgment. And that also applies here. Let's be curious about how this was able to happen and why it happened, rather than judge those who were the victims. I think that Birchtold was able to fool an entire school system and had multiple other victims. So it shows just how slippery he was. Jan's parents were Mormons and from a different time. Nowadays, we're all extremely well educated, thankfully, about the presence of paedophiles. And hopefully this episode will serve as yet another reminder in our culture. So I'd urge listeners, no matter how incredulous they feel, not to blame the victims or add to their woes by trolling and that kind of thing. Birchtold was likely a high-functioning psychopath who would stop at nothing. Jan will tell us the whole story for the first 20 minutes or so before we go into the whys and the hows and we let it unfold. And it's a really interesting chat. I loved talking to Jan. Things do get emotional at some point, so be ready for that. I had a great chat with her, really enjoyed her company. She's a really lovely, smart person. She went on to have a career in acting. Her mother then wrote the book Stolen Innocence, the Jan Broberg story, so do look into that. She has a series called A Friend of the Family, now with Universal, that will stream on an NBC service called Peacock. There's 9 episodes of it about her story, so look out for that. Anna Paquin and Colin Hanks are starring. The Jan Broberg Story podcast is coming out too, so do keep an eye on it, watch this space, and follow Jan on Instagram on @JanIBroberg. And now you're on the edge of childhood abuse and stolen innocence with Jan Broberg. Jan Broberg, welcome. You are on the edge. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. Man, we've been trying to get this going for some time, haven't we? We keep missing each other. Now we're finally here.
We are finally here. It's great to see you and to be here, Andrew. Thank you.
Oh, it's very, very exciting. So I've been wondering how to sort of do this, because I think a lot of people will have seen the documentary on Netflix, Netflix Abducted in Plain Sight. I suppose maybe, depending on how you feel, would you like to sort of roughly go over your story a little bit for those who haven't seen it, and as a reminder for those who have?
Sure. So in a nutshell, we met a family, mom, dad, 5 kids at church when I was 9, and we became best friends. We did hundreds of activities together. Everything from picnics and boating and snowmobiling, and they had a trampoline. They had all the fun toys, and we spent a lot of time at their home, rode our bikes together. The oldest four were boys, same ages as me and my two younger sisters, and then another little boy and a baby girl, and literally felt like this would be a family that if my parents died, you know, I could be raised by this family. That's how much we loved them. That's how close we were. And the whole time, apparently, the target was to eventually kidnap me and sexually assault and abuse me over a 3, almost 4, actually, year period of time. So at age 12, I woke up after taking what was, I thought, my allergy pill to go horseback riding with the father of this family who had a client, so he said, for his furniture store that we were going to go pick up some furniture. And he said, but I'll take Jan horseback riding. He has horses. And I'd been there before. I'd been horseback riding before. And again, this is like my favorite uncle. This is like somebody I was so close to. And so eventually my mom said, okay, but get her home, you know, early because it's a school night. And instead he gave me my allergy pill and I woke up groggy. It knocked me out and in the back of a moving motorhome, strapped to the bed by my wrists and my ankles. And in my ear was playing a voice that sounded, now remember, this is 1974, October of 1974. Big time in the history of all time when Roswell and UFO sightings and lots of science fiction movies, you know, Star Trek and Lost in Space were on TV and we were going to movies that were all around that same theme. And when I woke up, this voice in this little intercom looking box was calling me by name. Well, she wasn't calling me by name. It was female companion. It is time for your mission to begin, is what it was saying. And then it would give me short staccato phrases of instructions, telling me I was special, telling me they had been watching me since I was born. They knew me and that eventually what the whole, I guess you would call it brainwashing scheme that he used was that I was to have a child to save this alien planet, that I was half alien, half human, and that I was, my mother's name happens to be Mary, and that I was the child that would save, that would give the planet their savior to save their planet. Now, all of this came out over a period of time as this man drove me into Mexico, was trying to get me to South America, and I was not found for about 45 days the first time. And then I came back home. He pled insanity, that his depression had gotten the best of him. I never talked because I thought that these aliens were watching me all the time. I was the female companion. They had told me he was the male companion. He would be the father, the sperm donor, the whatever, of this child that would save the planet. And of course, he was mortified and he was such a good actor. Oh my word, how can I do this? How will we do this? And the whole thing was premeditated and planned by this pedophile who was also a father of 5 who had molested girls before me. I know this now, and girls after me. And a lifetime of crime in this kind of way. And after I was home, back to the story, for about a year and a half, contacted by him. He was in a mental institution for a short period of time. But all this contact I kept having with him or with the aliens, with the alien box that would show up in my bedroom. Lots of intimate little stories here that I won't go into. You have to read the book or watch the documentary or the series, which is coming out this fall. But he kidnapped me again. a second time at age 14. I was 12 the first time, 14, barely had turned 14 the second time. And this time he took me to California. He enrolled me in a private boarding school. And so I was very much off the grid. And again, the entire time for 4 years of my life, I really thought this story was true, that they were watching me. It wasn't until I was found the second time, which was almost 4 months later, and brought home. Another year and a half goes by. I'm turning 16, which was the magic age. I was supposed to have the child to save the dying planet before the age of 16. Of course, none of the rules applied. I was still pre-puberty. I wasn't all human. I was part alien. So the rules were different for me and my body and everything. I hadn't gotten pregnant to have this alien child through all the rape and all of the abuse and sexual assault. I was at this boarding school for almost 4 months. It's, you know, been quite the ride. He would come take me out. He had told the nuns, it was a Catholic boarding school, that of course he was my father, that he was a CIA agent, that we had escaped Lebanon crisis. That was the what was happening at that time in our history, and that my mother had been killed in Lebanon. So to be sure not to tell anyone if they might come looking for me that I was there, because then they would take me, torture me to get to him. And so, of course, the wonderful nuns at the Catholic school had several visits by several private investigators and police officers, detectives, before they actually believed them and said, yes, the picture of that little girl, that is her. Her name is Janice Tobler. We thought, they're like, this is Jan Broberg. She's been kidnapped by this man, and they brought me home. So after I was home the second time, the brainwashing was pretty severe. I never, ever told anybody about the aliens, about the mission to have the baby, about the sleeping, relaxing pills. That's what he would call them. You have to take your relaxing pills, about the medication, and certainly nothing about him ever harming me or touching me or anything. Never, ever during this whole period of time. So after the second time, the communication coming from the alien box or from him, which would show up at times in my bedroom, was less than the first time. I was getting older, but I was still pre-puberty. The idea was that I had been told was that I was half alien, half human, and so was my little sister, Susan. And so if I could not have the baby to save the dying planet by the age of 16, then she would be taken and she would have to fulfill the mission. Well, of course, I didn't want that to happen to her. I followed all the rules because there were many threats. If I were to talk to a boy at school or have a relationship with my dad, then my dad would go missing or be killed, or my sister Karen would be blinded. And it was amazing how much the brainwashing centered around threatening my family members, because children and young people will not tell you, even if you've had a wonderful, open childhood like I did. I had parents that I talked to all the time. They listened. We ate dinner together around the table, but immediately when the right threats are put in front of a child who cares and loves her family, they won't tell. So when people think, oh, we'll teach our children, they'll tell me. And I'm like, no, they won't. Anyway, back to the story. I did not have the first moment until right before my 16th birthday. I was at a drama camp because I love theater. I love acting, always had since I was really young. And at that camp, a boy had bought my ice cream at the cafeteria line where we would go eat. It was on a university campus, and we would go eat there, or go get treats there. And he paid for my ice cream. And I thought, oh no, my dad's going to be dead tomorrow. My sister, Susan, will be missing. Karen will be blind. The dogs will be dead. I don't know what will happen to Mom, but I knew something terrible was going to happen.
Because he paid for your ice cream?
Yes, because one of the rules from the aliens, from the thing, was I could have no relationship with other boys, including my father. That they were all not good. keep them out of the way so that the male companion could be the only person that would have access to you to impregnate you for the mission to have the baby for the alien planet. So I know it's laughable. Go ahead and laugh. It's fine.
I should just say that I don't think anybody would judge you badly for this at all. I don't want you to think that. Nobody would laugh. On this podcast, we've had lots of stories of surviving abuse in all sorts of different ways, cult thinking and ideologies and stuff. And, you know, one of the things I often mention is the writer of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, was supposed to be the master of deduction and rationality and logic. He believed in fairies as an adult man in a time when, you know, it wasn't normal to believe in fairies, that, you know, even incredibly intelligent adults can be led to believe things if the situation and the circumstances are right. So I don't think anybody would be judging you at all. And I'm so sorry. Let me just say, actually, I'm so sorry that you went through all of this. It's a horrific story. And I really don't want you to feel that anybody's laughing at you. Is that something that you still feel?
You know, it's funny because that's what kept me from telling my story publicly for a long time. I wanted to help people. Way back when I was in my late 20s, I had been asked to speak about my story at a little, like a book club of women, and I did, and other little things here and there. But I always thought, you know, people will think I was so dumb for believing this. But over time, I actually, now that I'm an expert on grooming and I know how grooming happens, how all of the factors were put in place before he ever kidnapped me, all the trust, all the science fiction movies, everything that was there that looked innocent was all a ruse. And now that I understand that, I'm not as worried. Some people will they're going to criticize you no matter what. That happens. But for the most part, I really overcame that fear because I knew what was true. I know it. It doesn't matter if you don't know it. Maybe you've never been conned. Maybe you've never been groomed. Maybe you've never had a moment in your life where you were like, oh my gosh, I made that bad decision because I thought this person was trustworthy, or I thought that that vacuum would solve all my cleaning needs, whatever it is that conned you. Maybe you haven't made the connection between, oh, that sales pitch, that con man, that's what happened to her and her family. But for the most part, I really am not too afraid of that. I just know that it's a really outlandish story, unless you grew up in the 70s where UFO sightings were in the paper and your parents and Birchtold, the man who kidnapped me, are talking about, could this be, you know, people coming now from other worlds and other universes, the gathering of Israel. They would use certain terms. He would use certain terms that were familiar to me from a religious standpoint in the narrative. And that made it, for a little 9, 10, 11-year-old who was just overhearing this conversation, it made it like, oh, maybe that is what's happening, you know, because they inculcate. It's that inculcation of something familiar, and then they twist it, which is literally what the story of my having a child to save a dying planet also was. It was inculcating the Joseph, Mary, and Jesus story that was very familiar to me. We acted it out every Christmas, and taking that same story and twisting it into and inculcating it with this other information, or this, whatever you call it, this plan. And so that's a big part of the story of brainwashing and the story of grooming. So as I was just telling you about that miracle when that boy bought me the ice cream and I thought something horrible was going to happen, I remember rushing back to my dorm room and just throwing myself on my little bed thinking, oh no, please, please. I didn't know he was going to do that, talking to the aliens, you know, above me that were watching me. I didn't know that would happen. And my parents called me every day of this, you know, theater camp, because it was about 2 hours away from our home. And of course, they were very worried about letting me go, but they knew theater was kind of saving my life. They knew something had happened to me, but they didn't know what. And so I'm at the camp and this has happened. And And mom and dad call, as they always do that evening. And I'm like, what's going on? How is everybody? You know, acting like, tell me who's dead. You know, they don't know this. And mom says, well, I had to take Tiffy, our dog, to the doctor because she got, she was convulsing. She was like throwing up so hard. And I was like, oh no, it's my fault. And she's like, what are you talking about? It's not your fault. I said, what about Bandit, the other dog? Well, she seems okay, a little groggy, or like maybe she's sick too, but I think I must have fed them something bad, says mom. Well, I, in my mind, well, immediately you connect all those dots that it's my fault. I let this boy do this, and now I'm in trouble, and my dogs are going to be dead by morning. So I have this kind of tearful cover up. Oh, okay. Oh, I hope they're okay. Please call me. Tell me how they're doing. Okay, I love you. Is Susan home? Yes. Is Karen okay? Yeah, we're all good. Dad's here. You know, it's the weekend. Everybody's going to be okay. Everybody's fine. You know, not knowing what's going on in my head, the weight of the world on my shoulders. So I call, or I tell them to call me the next morning. They call me back, which is not customary. It's usually in the evening that they would call. But they called me the next morning, and it was a Sunday morning. And mom said, you seem so upset, Jannie. And I want you to know that the dogs are fine. Tiffy's doing really well. Bandit, whatever was, you know, groggy or lethargic, she's running around like normal. Everything is fine. And I just wanted you to know that. You seem so upset. And at that moment, here is the moment. For 10 seconds, I had a thought. Oh my gosh. Is this real? Are they real? Before I kill myself, and before I tell Susan about the mission and kill her, I better find out if this is real. Because that plan was already in place. I was going to finish the theater camp, which my birthday, my 16th birthday, was during the theater camp, finish the show, and then that's what I was going to do, kill my sister if she didn't want to do the mission, and then kill myself. That 10-second thought is what opened the door to me testing the waters. And this is a year and a half after the second kidnapping, mind you. I've been under this influence of brainwashing for another year and a half. So I start testing the waters. I go back home. I don't respond to seeing Birchtold at the theater camp. He has this person who's handed me a note. He wants to meet me off campus. I don't respond. I don't go. Nothing happens. I go home. I start school. I'm in high school now. I've turned 16. I've never been on a date. I've never even talked to a boy, practically. I accept a date to the homecoming dance that we're going as a group date. I'm terrified. I know that if I can get through that date and come home and have my family intact, and that's exactly what happened. And my dad was waiting up for me in his chair as I came home from my first date. And I literally walked through the door, and he was in the dark. He had fallen asleep in his chair. It was dark. I walked through the door of my home, and he says, Jannie, how was it? Did you have a good time? Now, mind you, I've barely spoken to or touched my dad since the second kidnapping. Barely, because I'm not supposed to. I went over, and I literally sat on his lap. As a 16-year-old girl, I hugged him and said, yes, I had a great time, Dad. It was so much fun. Sorry. And then I told him a little bit about the date and what we did and all my friends, my girlfriends that were with me on that group date that loved me through all of this, as did my family. Without knowing why I was acting so weird and strange. And I went back to my bedroom, which had been moved to the upstairs. I couldn't sleep in my downstairs bedroom anymore. It was the old den upstairs. And I laid on the bed on top of the covers. And I was in shock. I was literally in shock. I'm like, I passed Susan's room. There she was, in her bed asleep. Mom was in mom and dad's room in bed asleep in that same hallway. I knew Karen was downstairs perfectly fine in her room. And I just sat there, literally. I knew I put these here for a reason. Literally in shock. My thought was, now what do I do? Now what do I do? Who am I? If I'm not saving a dying planet, do I tell people? What do I say? It was so overwhelming, I can't even describe. And it took a while before I got it out when my best friend Caroline and my sister Karen cornered me, having found some notes that Birch Toll had written to me earlier in the years that I had hidden in the cushion of my big sofa chair, hanging chair down in my old bedroom, as they were making it into a new bedroom so that I could sleep down there again, decorating and painting and changing things. Everybody so good to me. And that's when I was then cornered and started to talk about it, first to Caroline and Karen, and then to Mom and Dad. And slowly I talked about the sexual assault that had happened, but it took me a long time to get those words. I was still just 16 and scared and didn't know if it was my fault. I literally went to my religious leader and confessed that I had done this terrible thing. And lucky for me, he was a good bishop. And he practically crawled across his desk and threw his arms around me and said, oh my word, no, you didn't do anything wrong. Nothing that happened to you is for anything for you to be feeling bad about or ashamed of. And I'm so sorry. And we love you. And that was a lucky moment for me. Not all religious leaders would have been the same.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you think that, I mean, when it all started with the alien story, I mean, I'm telling you, if I woke up drowsy and all that kind of thing and heard that at that kind of age, 10, 11, 12, I believe that 100%. I would be like, oh my God, yeah, absolutely. Do you think as the years went by and you got to about 16, do you think there was maybe a small side of you that knew that maybe this isn't right, but to admit that would be to acknowledge what was really going on, which was far darker than it, just too dark to confront at that age?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, getting into high school and just that much older, definitely having other experiences, at least around me, even if I wasn't participating, I had a best friend who was dating and having the time of her life. And, you know, and I was kind of living vicariously through her. And, you know, I knew even earlier, because she'd been my best friend since I was 9 as well. You know, we'd read the health books and looked at all the pictures together. You know, I knew enough about all of, you know, reproductive things to have at least a working knowledge, if I were human, what that would be. So yes, I think there was a part of me that certainly wanted it not to be true, but the fear was too great. I was too afraid that, what if I challenged them and all of a sudden my sister really did disappear? My other sister was blind. My dad was dead. I mean, there were many things that happened in between where Birchtold had people burn my father's store to the ground. The entire building and that block in Pocatello, Idaho, is gone. He set fire through these two arsonists that he paid. And so that had happened right after the second kidnapping. So I'm believing I did something wrong there again. Like, it was me. It was my fault. Somehow I must not have followed the rules. So your brain, when you're in a state of being manipulated and brainwashed, your brain fills in the blanks. He doesn't even have to tell you that anymore. To the question that you asked me, yes, I do think that I was just old enough and starting to have some place in my brain, a question like, is this real? Are they real? You know, and it's getting later in the 70s and I don't see as much of the talking about UFOs and Roswell, mostly because Birchtold isn't at my home, you know, because he was the one that did all of that, you know, so.
And to compound everything, I think back then people didn't even use the word pedophile, did they? It was before my birth kind of thing. It was a completely different, it was like a dirty old man, they said in the UK at least. So he's a bit of a dirty old man. Was it similar over there?
Yes, very similar. And of course, the dirty old man has an immediate image that comes to mind. It certainly didn't look like this guy, who looked as clean cut, and he's a businessman, he's a father and a husband of five children, you know, and it's like, certainly he isn't a dirty old man. There would never be that thought in my parents' mind, especially because my dad and he went to, you know, Rotary Club and the Chamber of Commerce meetings together. You know, dad owned a flower shop. He owned a furniture store. He just knew exactly how to build that trust. So yeah, they knew what a child molester was, but even my FBI agent at that time was a new young FBI agent. And he even said, could he be like, I think the word is pedophile. And they said, what's that? And he said, well, you know, like a child molester, but I'll have to go look it up in the handbook to tell you the exact definition. I mean, you know, child abuse laws didn't even exist in 1974 in the United States. They hadn't even been adopted state by state. They were just being talked about through the House and Senate and the federal government. Child abuse laws. People don't get it. Like, well, why wasn't there better counseling? Because there were no counselors, because there was no crime, because it hadn't been put in place. I mean, there were counselors, but if you saw a counselor, we weren't talking mental health. That word hadn't even happened. We were talking, you must be crazy if you're seeing a counselor. It was such a shameful thing. So interesting, different time.
Do you think that your story perhaps stands out from others of child sexual abuse because he also had affairs with both of your parents, your mom and your dad?
Yes. So I think that is a really interesting question, because the affair that he had with my mom, which happened in between the two kidnappings, the three or four times that she actually slept with him, became this big, what I think the documentary leaves unsaid is that he was working on everybody, right? He's leading everybody, divide and conquer, separately designing a special relationship with mom when dad's at work, with dad when dad's at work. Let's go to lunch, Bob. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let me open up my personal stories to you. Let me have your complete empathy. Let me tell you why I'm not in love with my wife. Why do we do this married thing? Why don't we go get our own bachelor pad? You know, and getting dad to talk about things that I don't think he talk to anybody else about, you know, about his twin brother and his cousins and, you know, things that they did as kids or as young teens. And, you know, like he would pull things out of people with his own emotional telling of his own stories of abuse, or, oh, this lady that I, you know, knew when I was 17. And, you know, he just knew how to get people to be so close to him that he could lead them down that path. Because the masturbation experience that happened with my dad and him in that car was a one-sided experience. And it was just my father, you know, helping out a friend and then feeling guilty about this thing that happened, this masturbation act, for the rest of his life. Like, why would I have ever done that other than the fact that he could make you feel like you were, you know, 16 years old. That's the truth. And so it's really interesting to me how my parents were so honest and brave to tell those things, because it's a tactic that a lot of manipulators do use. They figure out how to divide and conquer, how to get everybody worrying about their own feelings that they know they shouldn't have, and their own actions that they know they shouldn't have done, and get them in that place. And then they're even more likely not to be looking at this guy in any other way other than, oh, I made this stupid mistake with this person, and why would I do that? You know? And my dad's thing was before the first kidnapping. That masturbation thing was before the first kidnapping. And my dad never let him back in our house or had any relationship with him after that.
Do you think that Butch Told, as well as being a pedophile, might have been a psychopath and maybe even a bit of a genius? I mean, I don't mean to compliment him at all. I hope that's clear. Just a very smart guy, the way he went about things.
Yes, I do think he was very intelligent. And I think he spent a lot of time reading books. I don't know that he read books on brainwashing themselves, but think about the butterfly effect that was around. That information on some of those techniques, it was in the atmosphere at that time. And I think that he had this overactive kind of imagination. I think he thought about it all the time. I literally, now that I know some of the girls before me and some of the girls after me, one of whom he also used those same brainwashing tapes on, it's like this guy was a continual, how am I going to get my way? Who do I need to take out and fall down and make them, you know, get out of my way so that I can get to my victim? And he always had more than one lined up. Like the next little girl he was going to abuse, he met her mother at the psychiatric hospital, which is where he was sentenced to go. And she was a psychiatric nurse and single. And her daughter was 9 years old. And that was that girl who he met in between my two kidnappings. He became best friends with this girl's mother, who was a psychiatric nurse at the mental hospital, and then abused her daughter. I have the police report on that one for almost 8 years, until she almost killed herself and her mother dragged it out of her after a friend called her, and they convicted him. She couldn't believe it. And, you know, all those years being best friends. And he was convicted and put in jail in Salt Lake City for rape of a child. That is exactly what the conviction was. But he was out of jail in less than a year.
Which is mad in itself, isn't it?
Yes.
So how long did he spend, in prison overall? Because he's no longer with us, is he? Birch told. I think he died. But how long did he spend for his various crimes in prison?
For the only ones I know about are for the other little girl between me, which was about 10 months in prison. And for my two kidnappings and what happened to me, he was sentenced to 45 days in jail. But with time served, he only spent 15 days in jail and then stints at the mental hospital.
That's a disgrace, isn't it?
It is.
That makes me so angry. It doesn't make any sense. It's like you can't punish him now. He's gone.
Right. Yeah, it's really an amazing story that tells how much work there is to be done in our justice system, because what happens is parents, and certainly victims most of the time, are not telling at that time, right? They're older, now maybe they're young moms or dads or whatever, and now they want to convict or tell at least, and they really don't know where to start, and they really don't have any assistance. So a lot of times in the justice system, according to my sister Sue, who's an attorney, she's like, you don't know what you don't know you don't know. So people don't even know the questions to ask. Like in the documentary where my parents went to talk to his attorney, because she called and said, hey, we can make this whole trial go away. Just come down here and talk to me. I'll show you what we can do. Well, they went. And everybody's like, why would they do that? And then the FBI agent and the district attorney and all the other people are like, why would you do that? And my parents are like, We didn't know we shouldn't go talk to her. We've never had an attorney. They don't have an attorney advising them. My case is a state and federal case. They don't have an attorney. They've never been in trouble with the law. They don't know anything about what is okay and not okay. They don't even know the questions to ask. They were just hoping that it would, you know, it would be something that would make it easier on their daughter to not have to go to trial. So they sign those affidavits, and then the documentary leaves out the fact that they also retracted those affidavits. There's an article in the newspaper that says Broberg's take back their statements. They say, we're ready for it to go forward. It was all because of the thing that had happened with my dad. And my mom didn't want that to be exposed to everybody, and my dad didn't. But then they took them back. They said, oh, well, if that gets exposed, let the case go forward. And that was, you know, but that was left out of the documentary.
I mean, it's a really complicated one, isn't it? Because it is really frustrating that people will get in touch with you, I'm sure, or you might hear people being very judgmental, and they weren't there. They weren't in those precise set of circumstances. At the same time, would you say, looking back, that maybe your parents were a little more innocent to these kinds of things, which to be honest is no bad thing, because this stuff was so far from their minds. That's the thing. And I mean, he was sleeping in your bed at what, 4 times a week for 6 months or something, and it just didn't cross their mind, did it?
Well, and he wasn't sleeping in my bed. See, I think that the documentary misled people in some ways, which is why I'm so glad we're making a 9-part series with NBC that will stream on Peacock in the fall, because it couldn't tell the whole story. It's a 9-year story. Just that little section is really a 9-year story shoved into 90 minutes, right? So it left out the part that he wasn't sleeping. He was laying on top of my bed, not under the covers. My door is wide open. My mother is coming in and out, putting laundry away. He has these big headphones on, just like what we're wearing. And he's listening to these tapes that were given to him by a psychiatrist that he said he met and knew in California that was trying to help him with his depression. And because the person in his life who had abused him and started the depression at about age 12, it was a female, it was his aunt, he was supposed to find a child that was, you know, around that age, 10 or 11, that's when it started for him. And he didn't really even use the word abuse. He said just the depression and what happened to me. He had told my dad at one time that an aunt had abused him, but they didn't go into a lot of detail. My dad didn't put that together like anything. Nobody has these conversations in 1972 and 73. And so he was supposed to listen to these tapes. What's interesting to me is that they were about 20 minutes long. It was about twice a week that he would lay on top of my bed with the door open, mom and dad, and then he'd go upstairs and have a conversation with mom and dad. I think these are helping. I think this is really helping me. My depression is much better. I can tell it's doing something, right? Again, he always had an answer for everything. So I think what's amazing is that when I did in 2019, the Dr. Oz show, he actually told me behind the scenes, not on the show, but he actually told me, he said that therapy was a thing in the 70s. He said it was debunked that it didn't work. He said, but that was one of the early things as psychotherapy was just getting started. It was just in its infant stages, and people were supposed to listen to tapes, and they would say things about, I don't know, trying to reprogram your brain from what had happened at that age. He said, so it's interesting because I knew that, but he said most of the world wouldn't know that.
So I'm getting a feeling from you that, do you feel that the Netflix documentary, which was huge around the world, I mean, I was living in Argentina at the time, and it was out there, and people were talking about it and watching it, and your parents did come across in the documentary as very, very naive. And I'm getting the sense that, do you feel slightly betrayed by the makers of the documentary?
A tiny bit. Because I remember when I saw it at the director's home the first time, and there were several parts, I was like, you have to take that out, or you have to finish that story, because it leaves everybody hanging. But, you know, she was a very good documentary filmmaker, and I was just a girl with a story. I didn't know, you know, I don't claim to be a filmmaker. And so I acquiesced to her, you know, what she thought would really make it intriguing, which it obviously did. It did its job in that way. But I do think my parents were innocent and naive in some ways, but not in a way that made them different from anybody else in our community. They were also very intelligent. My mom was a sorority leader at the university for Lambda Delta Sigma. She was the Miss Pocatello pageant director in the community. She was a, you know, she played the guitar. She was a musician. My father was a pianist as well as a designer and a florist. And they were very well respected in the community. They both held positions, had friends that were in political positions, our neighbors, you know, some of the doctors and lawyers in town were some of my parents' best friends, you know. So they had never had their own personal attorney because they'd never been in trouble. They never had needed one. They left their doors open at night, as did all of my neighbors. We all went to church with probably 30% of our neighborhood. We all, you know, communed together at church, which was just basic Christian principle church. I mean, a lot of people have weird ideas about Mormons, so I get that it's really fun to try and make them super weird, because then that takes you off the hook. Oh, I would know, because I'm not stupid like those people. But actually, Mormonism is a really pretty benign Christian religion, and it really is not weird at all. Now, the polygamists are strange, but they're not Mormons. They are a whole different cult.
They're quite extreme from what I can gather, aren't they? I have interviewed former Mormons, former extreme Mormons, and it's, I get exactly what you're saying. There is that thing of like, well, I'm so much cleverer, and look at me pointing out all the problems. And it goes back to what I say about the intelligence trap. I think it sounds like your parents may well have been extremely intelligent in most things, and then just this little gap with this guy, but it's who apparently also managed to find that gap in a lot of people. So you know, it's a really complicated one. And the Mormon community does seem to be, and again, I'm generalizing here, very trusting and sort of quite smiley and nice from the outside. Is that sort of a fair?
Yeah, that's pretty fair. I think that people in general, I mean, there's a few that I've come into that are, you know, judgmental and self-righteous. But for the most part, the people that are my friends that I've had throughout my upbringing and my life now, they're really good people. And they really are happy people, and they want to serve, and they want to do what's right, and they want to be kind and, you know, basically keep the Ten Commandments. That's basically, they believe in Jesus Christ, in the atonement, in the basic things that I would find if I went to church with one of my Catholic or Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian friends. And I have friends in all of those, or my Jewish friends. They may not believe in Christ like I do in the same way, but they are very similar to me in their family is close. The things that they believe are right and wrong. So it's an interesting look at Diane Sawyer. Actually asked me on an interview back in 2005, long before there was a documentary, long before, you know, there was a book, a self-published book, but long before all of this. And she said, well, don't you think that highly religious people are more susceptible to brainwashing? And I thought about that for a few seconds. And I said, you know, I think what happens is that because we are taught to have faith in something, we sometimes miss the idea of letting our children and people in general really find facts. We should encourage that as much as teaching faith. When we encourage somebody to, you know, have a principled path in life, we should also realize that those ethics transcend this religion. They should have the opportunity to explore many paths that, you know, would be an ethical way to live their lives and not have any shame involved. Those are the mistakes that religions make when they teach their children and their teens, in my opinion, is that there's not enough wind beneath their wings to say, be curious, find facts, figure out what works for you. Here's what's worked for me as your mom and dad. Now you figure it out if this works for you, and to be smart and to be curious and to be full of questions.
This might be a debate for another day, really, but I suppose some religions might be fearful of encouraging their devotees to be too curious and to probe too much about facts, because To be religious, and I'm not criticizing at all, I'm just saying to be religious requires some level of magical thinking, some level of faith, and an absence of facts in that sense.
And I agree with you. It's why I am far less religious now at this point in my life than I used to be. And I'm far more of an open-minded, questioning, very open-hearted to a lot of people and whatever that path is for them, that I respect that and I really encourage that. And that's a lot of what I think makes me unique in this setting and situation, you know, with two parents who were extremely devoted. And I am what I call a cautious believer and a curious believer, and I don't know anything. I hope that there is an afterlife. You know, I hope for certain things.
Tell me about it.
I bet with the kinds of interviews that you do, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine how your mind must explode.
My mind explodes, three times a week now doing this podcast. But I just, it would be great to have an afterlife. We could be doing these podcasts for eternity then. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be.
So do you mind me asking if your parents or either of them are still with us?
My mother is. My father passed away in 2018 in November, right before the Netflix documentary came out.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, me too. It was maybe a blessing for him because he was such a good man. And, you know, that one mistake. I said, Dad, we all make mistakes in life. We're human. We do things. We do bad things. Everybody does. I said, it's really different when you have a master puppeteer that's leading you down a path to do something like that.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, I got to say, like, whatever people might say about, you know, innocence about it or whatever might have been missed, he comes across as somebody with an absolute heart of gold. Like, he comes across as, like, the nicest, sweetest dad ever.
He was. He was really a unique individual. He was so loving and so good and so generous. And I hope that the series, you know, with these great actors portraying my parents will embody that, because he deserves that, as does my mother. She was more quiet, even-tempered. My dad was artistic and designer and musician, more passionate, kind of like me. But mom is the steady. And some people thought she was cold or unfeeling. I'm like, no, she's just shy and quiet.
How did she respond to the documentary?
She said, it's hard because we know we opened ourselves up to a lot of criticism, but my sister Susan took my mom and my dad's name, he had died already, off of Facebook and stuff when the documentary went crazy. And there was a lot of, you know, many thousands and thousands and thousands of thank yous. I mean, far outweighed the people that were super critical. The problem I have with people not relating to the story is that then they won't see the predator in their own life. Because if they think, oh, well, I would never do that, or oh, I would know, or oh, this or that, then they're not going to look, and they're not going to let that tiny, tiny little sound wave, that's what I call it, that little feeling in their gut, they're not going to give it any voice or time. They'll just dismiss it like, oh, well, that can't be true. That's my brother-in-law, or that's grandpa, or that's, you know, the leading attorney or the teacher of the year. That's what they'll do instead of actually listening to that. So don't check off my story. It's your story. It's everybody's story.
They call that the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is when people who know the least tend to be most confident about knowing the most about things like that. And then, of course, they won't. So were people getting in touch with you directly to criticize.
Yes, we had some of that on our Facebook pages and other things, and some really mean memes that were made of, you know, that scene with my dad and Berchtold and other things. And that was really hard on me and my whole family, my dad's, you know, sisters who are still alive, and my aunts and uncles of my mother and her siblings and my cousins and my sisters and all my friends, because they love my parents and they know how wonderful they are. And that was really hard. It was hard on my entire extended family and friends. Really tough.
What kind of person like watches a documentary about child abuse and then thinks, I know, I'll get in touch and make everything worse and make everything horrible? Just psychopaths, all of them. Should I encourage listeners to get in touch and say supportive, nice things to you? Is it nice to hear when people get in touch and say nice things?
It really is. I mean, on my Instagram or my Facebook page, when that comes through and a story comes through, my heart just gets really rainbow big. And that's what I want.
Everyone get in touch with Jan. Even if you don't usually with this podcast.
Well, no, just because I want to tell people's stories. We're starting a podcast to tell other people's stories. I've gotten 30, 40,000 messages of thanks and gratitude, and now I have words. And then they usually go on, at least for a paragraph or two, briefly share their story with me. Because so many people, you know, there's 75 million people in the United States right now who have had this kind of abuse. They're either experiencing it now as a child, they're a teenager or a young adult, or they're an adult that has had sexual abuse or assault or rape as a child. By almost always, 97% of the time, if you look at the statistics from RAIN and from the FBI and from the Missing Center for Exploited Children, 97% of those cases are by someone that they knew, that they trusted or loved as children. 75 million people in this country alone. I have no idea what the numbers are in the UK. That's just here in the United States.
Yeah, that's already more than there are people in the UK.
Yeah, 75 million. 4 out of 10 children. Yeah. So if you figure it's 4 out of 10, that's a good 10, 20, 10, 15 million in the UK. People that have had this story. They have this story. They have. They have had this kind of abuse. Maybe not in the same exact way, but
how does it continue to you know, the abuse, does it affect how you are today? Do you think of him often? Does it come into your mind?
Well, I don't think of him as often. I think of the abuse because my whole purpose for the next, you know, however long I can work and stay current on the issue is what I am turning my life to. So I'm starting a foundation, the Jan Broberg Foundation, that literally is to bring all the resources together and to create an online community for survivors of sexual assault and abuse and their orbit. Who are their loved ones that are affected? Is it a husband or a wife that's affected by that person, by their partner's abuse? Is it a parent? Is it a sibling? Is it an aunt? Is it a good friend? Everybody's been touched by this abuse. If you don't know someone close to you in your life that has gone through this, you are one in a million. Everybody, if it's not them, it's someone they know, has gone through this. So my foundation will bring the resources together, the online community together, so that when somebody like Jan Broberg, who is going through divorce number 3, has her little boy and wants a counselor so bad, but has no money, has no idea where to start because she knows things are still broken that need help. I need help. Had nowhere to go. That won't happen to anybody else. Because at one stage or another of the aftermath in a person's life, they will need resources and help. And I want to make sure that every person has access to that. So that's what the foundation's about. And that's what's going to become my work. I've been, you know, in the arts. I'm an actress. I'm the executive director of a theater company. And now I'm stepping away from all of that to literally just do this. So podcasting, a new book is coming out, the foundation, the series, another documentary. That's my goal.
Do you still need help? Do you think you still need help?
Yes, I still have a counselor. You know, I still have people in my life that I counsel with, and I do formal counseling, you know, still, because obviously at different points in your life, in your life's journey, different things surface. You know, before you had children, now I have a child. That's different than it was before. Now I need help with these things, or I've kind of gotten through my abuse until the day that I start having sex with a person, and now I can't figure out how to have it and have it be good. And I'm so wrapped up in this thing. I got to have some help with that. You know, get a little bit older, there's something else. And that's what I think people need. It's like being an alcoholic. You need AA, and Al-Anon is the other portion that needs the help as well. That is what this foundation and what this quest and that I'm on is literally to help, just like I look at the creator of AA and Al-Anon and go, wow, look how many thousands of meetings are around the world. Everybody has a sponsor, somebody they can go to when they're struggling. I want that for sexual abuse survivors and their family members.
Do you want to talk about your podcast coming out, or that series, or both? Tell me about those.
Well, I will tell you about the series, because that's so exciting, with NBC Universal, and it will stream on Peacock, which is a free streaming service. That's the NBC service. And it's a 9-part series. It has amazing actors in the leading roles. Anna Paquin is playing my mom. Colin Hanks is playing my dad. Jake Lacey is playing Birchtold. Leo Tipton is playing Gail Birchtold. And then the older Jan, I don't know, she's still a minor, so I probably won't say her age, but I'm sure you can find out who that is. A beautiful actress. And the young Jan just finished her part because it started filming. So young Jan has just finished, and she was just brilliant acting wise. And my son got to do a scene in it, and he said the new older Jan is just the sweetest and brilliant as well. So hopefully the series will really tell the story more fully, and then we can launch off of that the new book on healing, the new foundation, our new podcast. The Jan Broberg story is going to be everywhere, and it's only there to help you, the one person who doesn't know where to go or what to do next, because you've been through this, and then to prevent this as we get to understand what grooming looks like. What is it? How will I see it? I'm going to become that expert to try to teach you what that is so it doesn't happen to you.
Jan Broberg, you've been on the edge. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Jan, for being brave enough to tell your story and confront your trauma so that others don't feel so alone. Jan was absolutely brilliant to work with, and I wish her every success with her Jan Broberg Story podcast and the NBC Universal series on Peacock, a free streaming service called A Friend of the Family. Follow her on at Jan I. Broberg on Instagram. Get me on AndrewGold_OK on Instagram or Twitter. Come say hi and let us know what you thought of the episode. Make sure to leave reviews on Apple and Castbox. I've not had any for quite some time, well, a week or so, so nothing to read out here. But it has been lovely interacting with you all in the last few weeks on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm even thinking of starting a TikTok. All of you have a lovely day. I hope you're still enjoying the podcast as I strive to keep it up to 3 episodes a week. It's a lot of content, and quite frankly, I love doing it. Love hearing from you, and love you all. See you next time.